Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Lab Trends and Best Practices for Improved Outcomes. The presenter is Kim Warren, Senior Strategist, Optum, Eden Prairie, Minnesota.
All right, we'll go ahead and get started. Good morning, everyone. Morning. Thank you guys for attending the 7:30 a.m. session. Hopefully everyone is nice and caffeinated and you're ready to go this morning. Thanks for coming to my session. This is my first time speaking at EWC, so I feel really honored and privileged that you came to my session, so I appreciate that. I want to start the session off today by asking a question. Is this test really necessary? I bet many of you have asked that question before. Today, I plan to spend some time reviewing the data trends that we at Optum have been able to uncover through our library of laboratory ordering transactions, and then discuss how a robust decision support tool like CareSelect Lab can have you asking that question less frequently. All right, well, I'll start off with a quick introduction of myself. My name is Kim Warren. I'm a senior strategist on the customer experience team at Optum. This picture is 10 years old, so hopefully I don't look much different than that. But I work with our CareSelect clients, specifically CareSelect Lab and CareSelect Imaging. So I work on things like product optimizations, things like data analysis, intervention recommendations directly with the client. And ultimately, my goal is to help them realize the value of their contract through things like lab analytics and how they can use that ordering data to increase their lab efficiencies. I do have a few colleagues in the room today, so I do want to take a few moments to recognize them. They're specifically on the CareSelect team, so important that we recognize them. I think they're going to help with some of the question and answer at the end. So we have Laura McIntyre. She's right here. She is our general manager of strategic clients. We have Allison Connors. I don't know if she's probably still greeting people at the door. She is our senior solutions sales executive. And then we have Molly Lauer. She's in the back there. She is a senior strategist on our customer experience team as well. All right, so let's jump into our agenda and the objectives for today. I really want to start with setting the stage for the industry and where we're at, kind of level set the need for an organization to have a comprehensive laboratory utilization management solution. Then we'll get into some of those data trends that I mentioned. So we have a robust library of those laboratory ordering transactions from our CareSelect clients. So we'll get into some of the information we've been able to uncover through that. Then I'll talk about how the healthcare organizations that we're working with, how they've been able to address concerns in their laboratory ordering through the use of our clinical guidelines that Mayo Clinic authors, and then how they use our unique reporting capabilities. And then the last item here, key takeaways and best practices that we've uncovered over the years in working with those clients. And then we should have some time at the end for question and answer. All right, so again, I want to set the stage for the current state of the lab industry. I really don't think any of these statistics are going to come as a surprise to anyone in the room. I know many of you live this day in and day out, so don't think it's anything, you know, really shocking or unique. But important we do a level set here. So as an industry, you run nearly 13 billion lab tests per year and do that all while being 40% understaffed, which I think is really significant. And it's frustrating to know that 20 to 40% of those labs are often considered clinically unnecessary. So why is there such a high volume of clinically unnecessary testing going on? Well, we know it's due to things like consumer-driven testing. There's complexity in the lab order catalog. You know, you've got changing methodologies that providers are trying to keep up with. All this new evidence-based research that's coming out. So the list could just go on there. And then coupled with that, you've got this intense pressure on the provider, on the clinical laboratory staff to deliver results quickly because they want to avoid things like a misdiagnosis or a delayed diagnosis. And we know that research shows that 1/3 of medical malpractice claims are due to misdiagnosis or the patient not getting diagnosed quickly enough. So it's a serious concern. And then on top of all that, you know, Medicare cuts continue to drop reimbursement rates. Then you've got commercial payers who are continuing to push for lower lab spend. So all of that together, ultimately, it's going to lead to staff burnout. And I'm sure many of you in the room, you know, feel that pressure internally. So how do we address some of these concerns? That's really what I'm going to be here talking about today. I'll take you through what our Care Select lab tool is, and we'll talk about how a comprehensive lab utilization management tool really is the right solution. So in the next few slides, I'll go over some of the data trends that we talked about through the use of our data. All right, so based on 52 million laboratory ordering transactions we processed in 2023 from our Care Select client base, we've been able to uncover these learnings that you see here on the screen. So again, I don't think any of this is going to come as a surprise to anyone. I certainly think that these are things that you probably have encountered, and you know, you can agree that many of these issues that you see up here are probably what you're facing daily. So don't think anything's going to come as a surprise, but I think it's important that we talk through these. So the first thing is to not discount low-cost testing. We know that routine labs, daily labs, you know, they're ordered at high volumes. We see that in our data. They're ordered redundantly. They're ordered in an inappropriate time frame, and they're costly. But they get disregarded because oftentimes the individual test itself is inexpensive. So organizations tend to just say, okay, we're going to tackle the more high-dollar testing. But we'll see why in a minute, why that's not a good idea. And then the second learning here is that due to an uptick in that consumer-driven testing that I mentioned, and obviously increases in the availability of genetic testing, the inherited genetics category has a high fail percentage. It has the highest percentage of order inappropriateness compared to our other test categories. So what does it mean when I say a high fail percentage? So according to that clinical criteria that we have from Mayo Clinic, they're not passing those guidelines. And then the third learning here is that endocrinology has the highest spend. So endocrinology tests are commonly misutilized, and they represent the highest spend. And we know that because we look back in the chart for things like, you know, the patient's history, their diagnosis, their previous lab orders. We're looking at all that information, and when we look at that in our logic and compare that to our clinical guidelines, these tests are often misordered. And then the last learning here is that there are specific instances where tests with clinical similar utility are being ordered concurrently. So that's two orders in the same ordering session that have similar clinical utility, and we're saying either, you know, one test is needed or neither test in some case are needed. All right, so let's take a look at some of the data trends here. So what you see on the screen is inappropriateness percentage by testing category. So like I said, the inherited genetics category does have the highest fail percent out of all of our test categories that we have listed here at 43%. Again, that's new tests coming to the market, patients seeing things on social media and requesting those tests. So this is, genetic testing is a pretty popular category, and you know, our familial guidelines, the things that we're looking back on, you know, if it should be a once-in-a-lifetime order, things like that, they're often failing those guidelines. And then you see routine labs towards the bottom there at 6.5%. So that's a pretty low fail percentage, but you'll see on the next screen that you can't ignore the impact of order volume. So while it's a low fail percentage, we'll see it's quite high in terms of order volume. Okay, wow. Okay, so you can see here, routine labs at the very top at 36 million. So think about that. 36 million out of the 52 million laboratory ordering transactions that we looked at are coming from that routine lab category. So things like your CMPs, your BMPs, your CBCs, those are all being performed at extremely high volumes, and that's really going to have a disproportionate impact on clinical outcomes and spend. We've seen that. So we'll touch on the spend here in the next slide. And then you can see a little further down, you've got inherited genetics in terms of order volume. So fairly low order volume, but again, still high in terms of fail percentage. And then you've got endocrinology. That's the second one there at 9 million coming in second. All right. So spend by testing category. So endocrinology has the highest spend at 17.2 million. So it's a lot of spend, right? Which is interesting because we saw that, you know, 9 million of those sessions are being ordered inappropriately. And then you've got the routine labs at 36 million, but still endocrinology is the top in terms of spend. And then you've got that routine labs category at 15 million, almost 16 million. And then you've got the inherited genetics somewhere in the middle right there, around 3 million. So I do want to pivot a little bit and talk about that last learning that I mentioned. So I was mentioning concurrent orders. So again, this is where two tests are being placed in the same ordering session by the clinician, and oftentimes only one of those tests is going to be clinically necessary, or again, it could be that both are not clinically necessary. So we have four different categories here. So you see the inferior, superior test category. So that's really where we're saying that one test is really going to be the recommended study there. And we are looking for things like the patient's diagnosis. We're looking back in the chart for things like that to determine which of those tests would be appropriate. So it'd be something like your ESR and your CRP. We know that CRP is a more sensitive indicator of inflammation, and so that is often what's going to be recommended there. There's a few outliers, but when we see those placed together, we're going to recommend to the provider, you should really only order the CRP. We also have duplicate order checking rules. So panels being ordered with tests that are already contained in the panel. So that doesn't make much sense, right? So that's redundant ordering. We know that's probably going to lead to a denial. So we're going to discourage that behavior as well. And then you have tests, again, with similar clinical utility. So some of that is like encouraging reflex ordering. So that might be something like a urinalysis and urine culture. So obviously you shouldn't really order that culture unless you have the urinalysis ordered and you know the results of that first. So in that case, we'll recommend something like the reflex order instead of ordering those two tests independently together. And then you have the ordinal or sequential logic. So testing that should be performed, one test should be performed before another. So a good, easy, simple example of that is something like your TSH and your free T4. All right, so I just spent the last several slides going over all the data that we've gathered through our CareSelect Lab solution and then the areas that we've identified as the greatest areas of concern in those testing categories. So I think now the question is, how do we solve for that? So I'm going to give you guys some insight into what our CareSelect Lab tool looks like, what it has to offer, and how a robust decision support tool like this is really going to be the answer. So I think the first step here is we always start by analyzing those ordering transactions across an organization. So the data collection is really the most important part here. We do recognize that, you know, healthcare organizations have something like their laboratory information system that gives them all of this robust data. But the unique capabilities of our lab tool is that we have these clinical guidelines that are authored by Mayo Clinic, and we are integrated right into the EHR. So that's the unique part there. So while you can get a lot of information through the LIS, you're going to have that missing component of the published clinical guidelines. So with CareSelect Lab, orgs are able to examine the appropriateness of every unique lab, pathology, and genetic test order against those 1,800-plus guidelines that are authored by Mayo Clinic. So it says 1,800, but honestly, we probably have over 2,000 at this point. So we have a lot of clinical guidelines that they've been able to provide to us. And then the second item here is analyze those laboratory ordering patterns to identify acute areas of overutilization opportunities for improvement. So that's where we would start looking at that data, working with lab stewardship committees and governance structures and start offering them those advisory services and start determining what is the intervention strategies that they want to take. So you can see there, address areas of acute need with point of order guidance or alternative interventions. So in some cases, we would recommend something like an alert, but that is certainly not always the path that we recommend for our clients. Could be anything from, you know, build recommendations. So could be, preference list optimizations. Could be that test name changes. I just had a client recently do that. And that kind of minimizes the confusion in the order catalog when they're trying to look for something. It could be a variety of different things. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what our clinical content actually looks like. So what you see here on the screen is a grouping of our clinical guidelines, so what we call these modules. So we try to make it simplistic in terms of, you know, these categories that they fall into. So the first item you have here is frequency orders. So that's repetitive ordering, not clinically necessary. So a couple examples of that. It's going to be something like don't order a hemoglobin A1C more than once per 90 days. Could be as simple as, you know, don't order an ionized calcium more than once per day. And again, you know, that can come in the form of an alert, in the form of point of order entry guidance, but it doesn't have to. You know, we collect all that information on the back end, and our clients are able to go in, look at that information, and then determine from there, do we have a provider-specific issue? Is this a specific department, specialty, whatever it may be? And then they can work to target those specific areas. Can they do education? You know, could it be build optimization? Should you change standing order timeframes? A lot of different things that you can do there. Then we have our commonly confused tests. So tests that may be confused with one another. So a good example of that is something like a 125 vitamin D dihydroxy with your 25 vitamin or your 25 hydroxy. So we look back in the patient's chart for a diagnosis to determine if that 125 is the correct order. So we're looking for something like, do they have renal disease? Do they have hypercalcemia? Things like that. So those rules, we have quite a bit of rules that fall into those buckets. And then we've got our genetic tests, so those high-cost hereditary genetic tests. And most of the time we're looking to see, you know, has the patient had this order? So there's a lot of once-in-a-lifetime orders that should be taking place. And then sometimes we have components that are built into the EHR that ask questions about family history. And then that next category there, value-based testing. So a good portion of our guidelines also fall into that. There we're looking back for diagnosis in the patient chart, so any kind of history or risk of something to determine whether it's appropriate. We're also looking for previous test results. And then a couple other ones. You've got your superior testing category. So we kind of talked about that already with the concurrent orders, where there's an alternative test that's going to be offered to the clinician that has better clinical utility. And then we have our location-based, so tests that should only be performed in certain care areas. And then cost, you know, we can do some alerting based on the cost of the test, particularly if it's an expensive one. And then we have some sex and age guidelines, so tests that should be restricted by that. All right, so what do we do with all that information that is collected? That goes into our CareSelect analytics tool. So again, analytics is really the first thing that we are looking at once a client has implemented with us. So once they've gone live, that 30 to 90 day timeframe, we're really taking a close look at their data to determine where overutilization is happening. So again, you know, you have the ability in our tool to compare providers. You can get down to the provider, department, specialty, and counter department. We separate those out in counter department, ordering department, authorizing provider, ordering user. Lots of different ways that the data can be sliced and diced. But the most important thing is really to identify those outliers who are not ordering correctly. And then from there, organizations can determine how they want to intervene. So we talked a lot about that already. Build changes, alerts, education, things of that nature. And the reports have a lot of impressive features. One thing I will call out is that we have some unique capabilities in terms of cost analysis. So in our tool, you can see an overall savings opportunity. So we take the individual cost of the test. So we'll either take the organization's cost or we'll look at the CMS laboratory fee schedule. We put that into our tool. And so as they fail those guidelines, that information is added up into a savings opportunity. So you can look at the individual test level. You can even look and see what a provider is specifically costing you in terms of failing those clinical criteria. We also have something called our alert dashboard. So if a client does opt to turn on an alert, point of order entry guidance, we'll capture that in our tool. You'll be able to see that in our analytics dashboard, and you're going to be able to see the response of the provider, and you'll be able to see what is the realized savings. So if they took the recommended action, which is oftentimes canceling the order, but sometimes there is an alternative option, if they did that, we're able to capture that information and say, you know, Dr. Jones has saved you X amount of dollars by choosing, you know, to take the right path here. And then also, we'll capture the bypass and loss savings. So they didn't take the recommended intervention. If they didn't cancel the order, we're also capturing that as well. So what does our point of order entry guidance look like? So you can see that here on the screen. Hopefully everyone's able to see that. So we know that EHRs have native alerts that are built in. We know that, you know, EHRs like Epic, you can go in, build those out. Your IT team can do that for you. But the unique part about our solution is that if clients opt to do our alert, we set that up. So, you know, the maintenance burden has been lifted off of the IT team. They don't have to worry about that. And then in addition to that, again, we're able to capture those analytics on the back end and actually tie a cost savings to that, which is often the missing piece with organizations. They're not usually able to do something like that. So a couple important features of the alert. The alert is only going to display when clinically necessary, when clinically relevant. So if the provider passes the clinical guidelines, they're never going to see it. If they do see an alert, it's always going to be a soft stop. It's never a hard stop. And that's always going to display upon signing the order. So that's kind of the trigger there. You'll see the relevant clinical information in the BPA itself or in the alert itself. So you can see here with the CBC with differential, there was a previous CBC that was ordered. So all the tests that are contained in that panel, you'll be able to see the results there. And then the provider can choose to cancel the order, keep the order, and again, in some cases, depending on what the test is, depending on what the guideline is, they can change that order out right in the alert. They can order the new order right there and place that order. So I want to take a look at a case scenario where an alert would have actually helped. So this is a fictional case study. We've got our patient here, Edward Smith. He is a 65-year-old male. He's presenting with joint pain in the knees and shoulders. He was seen by his primary care physician. There's no joint deformity, swelling, erythema. Joint tenderness is noted, but there's no signs of inflammation or instability. So primary care physician ordered these labs that you see here on the screen, complete blood count. There was an ESR ordered, a high sensitivity CRP, and then a uric acid test. So sure, many of you know just by looking at this, the high sensitivity CRP is obviously the wrong test there. We're looking back at the patient's chart to see is there kind of, you know, is there a history or risk of cardiovascular disease, and that's not present. So we know that the high sensitivity CRP is not the correct order. An alert would have told the provider that. We also know that, again, ESR is not as sensitive as CRP. When we're looking for inflammation. And so the ESR was not a necessary order either. They also would have been alerted to that. And in the alert, they would have had a literature summary that they could pull up. It's an option to click that, so it's not an additional pop-up. But the provider would be able to say, okay, you know, let's just say, I think this is a simple example, but let's just say they were questioning that. They could go into that literature summary and look at those resources where the clinical guidelines are coming from. So the alert really would have prevented unnecessary ordering, which is going to reduce those lab resources that are being used. It's going to be no additional cost to the patient because they're not ordering tests that are unnecessary, and then there's not going to be any kind of delay in getting the patient the right test. All right. Now that we've spent some time talking about what a comprehensive solution looks like, let's talk about how organizations are using all these tools to drive success. All right, so I kind of mentioned this earlier, but 30 to 90 days post data collection, so after our clients go live, it's really when we start diving into the data, trying to find those top test opportunities. We certainly see trends across most health systems. You know, we see a lot of those routine lab orders being, you know, the central problems there. But we'll take a look at that data and then start discussing what are the intervention tactics that can be taken. So, again, we have advisory services on our side, and we'll try to guide the client on what the best solution is based on what other clients have successfully been able to do. And there's lots of influences to those intervention strategies, and we recognize that every organization's unique. You know, every organization's going to have a different build, different education resources. The culture is going to impact, you know, the organizational culture is going to impact things. So we certainly recognize that everyone has to kind of have a tailored plan there. And the data is going to tell them, do they have a systemic issue or is it a provider group issue? And that's really going to dictate where they spend their time in terms of intervention. So you can see here on the screen that we have categorized these actions into three of the categories here, gentle, moderate, and strong. So the gentle is going to be things like the education and guidance. So, you know, oftentimes that takes a lot of time for the organization, but it's a, you know, it's not interruptive to the provider typically. It's not like an alert. So a lot of organizations opt to go that direction. They can impact a large crowd. They can reach out to a large number of people. Also, data audit and feedback. So provider scorecard distribution. So if you do have those outliers, you're able to pull those reports, send those out via email or however, you know, organizations choose to send them out. And then that way they can keep track of those providers that are not adhering to the guidelines. And then you've got your moderate intervention. So again, that's going to be things like changes in the EHR. So some of those build changes. And then strong intervention. So that's going to be something interruptive to the provider. So it's either the alerts, it's going to be things like your order validation points, or, you know, they might force their providers to acknowledge why they're proceeding with an inappropriate order. I think the most important thing to recognize, though, is that a kind of a multi-approach here is necessary. We've seen that with clients. Research supports that. It's not as simple as just turning on an alert. You've got to educate your providers on that alert. You've got to educate your providers on the clinical utility of the test. And so we certainly try to help with that. Mayo Clinic as well, their subject matter experts help to educate as well. So, oh, is that my cue that my time is up? All right, so let's go through a few of examples of each intervention strategy in each category. So you've got general interventions here, so education, so we've already talked a lot about that. So that's going to be things like your formal sessions that you hold, webinars, staff meetings, peer discussion groups, and services, things like that. But the goal is ultimately going to be to change that order practice and then to help clinicians choose the right study. And again, easily accessible, right? You know, you can educate large crowds of people. It's relatively inexpensive, so that's why a lot of orgs kind of choose to go this direction. So we have an example here of a client who set up boot camps. And so what they did was each month they spent time going over a test family or a specific test category and reviewed that with their clinicians. And the result was they saw a reduction in their TSH and their free T4 being ordered concurrently. And then they were also able to see an increase in their thyroid function cascade, so that reflex testing. And then they also saw a reduction in the vitamin D ordering. And then the second example here is a large meeting that was held with primary care docs, where they reviewed data, their specific data, and then the goals that they had internally for lab stewardship. And then they tasked the provider groups with going back to their clinicians and educating them on the specific tests that they were ordering inappropriately. All right, so moderate intervention strategy. So I have two examples I'll go over here. So this is an example of a health system in the Midwest choosing a more non-interruptive approach to two tests that were being ordered inappropriately. So it was the high sensitivity C-reactive protein and then that 125 dihydroxyvitamin D. So again, we often see that there's a confusion in the lab test catalog. So this was as simple as just renaming this test. So the test that providers are typically looking for is coming up first in that order catalog. So again, pretty simple change, not really going to impact the provider very much. And you can see here what the results were. They were pretty significant. So they had a 77% reduction in that high sensitivity CRP, and then they were able to reduce their ordering for the 125 by a third. And the good news is they've been able to maintain this for the last 3 years. So you can see that behavior change. You know, they looked at their data over time. They set incremental goals, and they were able to determine, okay, behavior change has been reached, and they've been able to maintain that. All right, next example here this is actually my client. So what they did was, I think it was about 30 to 60 days after they had implemented the product, they realized through their data collection that they had a Lyme disease tick test that was failing quite a bit. It was one of their send-out tests, pretty expensive per test. And they started asking questions, why are we even ordering this test? They weren't even sure. So this is the test that it's testing the tick. It's not testing the patient. So I want to be clear on that. So we know that evidence shows that testing the tick does not really correlate to the presence of Lyme disease. And so they did talk to their infectious disease team, had lots of discussions about, okay, what is the clinical utility of this test? And then they determined, okay, yeah, we really don't have a reason to have this test in the order catalog. They removed it altogether. And it was just a quick win. So the estimated annual savings for that was $41,000, which may not seem like a lot, but really is when you're talking about just a single test and such an easy, simple intervention that they took. Also, fun fact, I didn't know this until I started working with this client, but apparently male ticks don't bite, so the test is not going to differentiate between the two. So, I don't know. I thought that was a fun fact. All right, so moving on to strong interventions. This is an example of another hospital in the Midwest. They looked at four low-value daily labs, so that's their routine lab ordering that they were looking at, and they did decide to put point-of-order entry guidance in for their clinicians. So through that, they were able to see a 20% reduction in the labs per discharge within the first month of turning on those alerts. And then the second item here, 22% reduction in the orders for those four targeted tests. And they have also been able to maintain those results. All right. So we just spent time going over those customer examples, customer outcomes. So how do they get there? Well, a big part of that is having a strong lab stewardship committee. You know, we try our best to help organizations kind of get their committees together. We recognize, I mean, a lot of our clients already have strong committees put together. But it's about bringing the right stakeholders to the table. So I won't go through all of this. I'm sure most of you in the room, especially if you're with a hospital or health system, you know how to put a committee together. But I think it's important that we at least kind of go through a few of these steps here. And I think the first thing is leadership endorsement. I think that's the most important thing, making sure that you have somebody at the executive level who is willing to support all the efforts that your lab stewardship committee is going to put forward. I've seen it too many times where a client doesn't have somebody at the executive level supporting them, and they're not able to move forward. They haven't been empowered to make those changes. So I think that is definitely the number one thing there, making sure you have the right stakeholders at the table. So you've got your providers. You want to make sure you have ordering clinicians that are sitting at the table, because obviously any changes are going to impact them. You know, your lab directors, managers, genetic counselors, IT, certainly want to make sure they're present. That way, you know, as you're discussing different intervention strategies, if it's going to have an impact on the build, they can go ahead and put those things in place quickly. And then the third thing here, determine when to meet and who is going to be responsible for what. I think that's, you know, pretty obvious. And then finally, setting goals early, making sure that you've defined a mission or a charter. All right, so what are some of those best practices that we've compiled over the years in working with our clients' lab stewardship committees? Well, the first thing is that, you know, quick, small wins, that's going to create the positive energy and help them gain momentum. So kind of the example that I was talking about with the Lyme disease test, that was something super quick that they were able to identify through their data. They leveraged that story. They pushed that out to their organization and said, look what we've been able to do with this tool. And then that kind of inspired further change. And then they were starting to, you know, they've already started to work on some of their daily labs, which are certainly harder to tackle. Second item here, don't disregard low-cost testing. So we spent a whole lot of time talking about that and overutilization of those routine labs. Third item here, underutilization is just as important as overutilization. So with our superior testing rules, again, we're often recommending an alternative study. So it's not to say that a test shouldn't have been performed. It may not be the right test. And then the last item here is consider starting your interventions on inpatient or outpatient practice. So looking at the care setting, that's really important. So we encourage our groups, you know, on the outpatient side, if they're, you know, looking for interventions, to focus on a test family. That typically works best. And then on the inpatient side, they often focus at the individual test level. Also, there's different leaders, so that makes an impact too. All right, I think that brings me to the end. Okay, yeah. So question and answers. I think we have time. I think my cue girl told me I'm right on time. So I had 1 minute left. Okay. All right, any questions?
I don't see any questions in the chat yet, but feel free to raise your hands or pose questions out loud. Who's our most frequent customer type, hospitals, health plans, et cetera?
Yeah, it's going to be hospitals and health systems. That's who we primarily work with, mostly health systems.
The question is, do we offer demonstrations?
Absolutely. Of course we do. Allison, yep, she's in the back right there. Allison Connor, she's our senior solution sales exec, so she can set that up for you if you're interested. Oh, that's a really good question.
How often are Mayo's guidelines updated?
Good question. So we update those with them annually. So they have dedicated subject matter experts that work on their side that are strictly dedicated to our product. So they're doing that research throughout the year, and then we update annually, usually at the beginning of the year.
If they don't have a guideline for a specific test, can we request one, or can we request a clinical-to-clinical presentation?
Yes to both, yes. So we have plenty of clients that will come to us and ask for, you know, guidelines for a specific test, and we don't have anything. Mayo doesn't have anything already crafted. So, yeah, we'll put them in touch. We'll put their organization and their scientists in touch with the Mayo Clinic experts, and they'll kind of talk together, and they'll come to a decision on clinical guidelines.
Mm-hmm. So. We have a nice collaborative partnership
with
them.
For sure. Yeah, our clients interact with Mayo. So, you know, they'll have interaction with us, advisory services through us, but they'll also have advisory through Mayo Clinic.
The question is around routine lab testing and how we handle wellness testing.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So a lot of our guidelines are formatted for the routine test. They are formatted for the inpatient setting, but we do have outpatient-only clients. I have one in particular that definitely had some overutilization of testing through their annual wellness, like they were performing it more than just annually. So we were able to write some specific guidelines for them. So we can craft those things per organization, and we'll talk to each client and their leadership and determine, what kind of clinical guidelines we can put together.
Is the list of our health plans that use this public knowledge or private?
I'm going to put that to you, Laura.
You can put that on
me. I'm going to put that on you, Laura.
I don't think it's something that we necessarily publish unless we have express permission from an organization. We don't generally share our client lists unless we have those sort of caveats in place with them. However, if there are specific questions, we're happy to go to a client and ask if we can interact.
I've never seen Mayo guidelines. You know, we participate in a lot in Policy Reporter. I don't know if anybody here uses Policy Reporter. It's an online tool that extracts all the medical policies and so mm-hmm. forth. And I've never seen a Mayo policy out there. So that's why it's not being caught or captured. So
they're curated by Mayo, not necessarily offered by Mayo. Mayo is deciding what to put in the database.
Got it. Right. Yes, that's a good explanation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very helpful.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you guys for your time.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.